Welcome, everybody. I am really delighted to be moderating this panel on suburban housing. It is sort of the sister panel. Some of you probably were at the panel this morning on affordable housing in New York City, and we're going to continue that conversation in thinking about the housing needs, housing as a regional issue this afternoon, and think about how do we encourage housing affordability in the suburbs. In this region. We're going to start with Melissa Kaplan, who is Connecticut Director at RPA. Of course, I know her as one of my former students. I'm very proud to say I think she was one of the few students who I actually allowed to write an individual thesis. That's something that was a wonderful thesis. And then after, Melissa's going to give an overview of some of the preliminary proposals that RPA is considering for the fourth regional plan related to affordable and multifamily housing in the suburbs. And then we're going to have a panel with some discussion about some of those ideas. And I'm delighted that we are joined by, in alphabetical order, Elaine Gross, who is president of Erase Racism, Chris Herbert, who's director of the Harvard Joint Center for Housing, and Peter Reinhardt, who is director of the Kislak Real Estate Institute at Monmouth University, and Jamie Rubin, who is commissioner of the New York State Homes and Community Renewal, and last but not least, Catherine Schaefer, who is deputy policy director at the Partnership for Strong Communities. And collectively, they have a whole lot of knowledge about affordable housing challenges and potential solutions in the region suburbs. So I'm really glad that you joined us. So Melissa?
Great, thank you. Can we hear me? Okay, great. So I'm just gonna start by framing the conversation for all of us, talking about some of the broader issues around affordable housing in the suburbs, and then talking about some of RPA's ideas and policy positions that we're putting out there that we want to discuss and hear from our panelists to hear their thoughts and feedback as practitioners in the field as to what they think about some of the ideas that RPA is working on for the fourth plan around suburban housing affordability. So I just wanted to start talking a little bit of context and where this all sits. Our housing market is obviously regional, but the trick here, especially amongst the suburban communities, we have 783 municipalities in the region. All municipalities are in charge of their own zoning, and so the way housing happens in our region is really on a place-by-place basis, you know, where housing's located and how dense that housing is. When you look at the map up on the screen, you can see that there are few suburban locations that have affordable housing in our suburbs that really, affordable housing is concentrated in our cities, not just New York City, but also Bridgeport, New Haven, Hempstead, Poughkeepsie, Newark, and we, you know, have a map showing rents below 1,000 per month, but we find if there were other metrics for affordability, you find it's a very similar picture, very similar map. And households are spending more and more on housing. We know this, I think, intuitively, but the data is really showing the extent of the problem. We're seeing that across the board, we have a third of our households spending more than 35% of their income on housing, and that's increased substantially in the last 20 years, by 10%, again, across the board. And this problem is rooted in a lot of history. Our suburban part of our nation was really born after World War II, returning vets, you know, coming home, the GI Bill, white flight to the suburbs, exclusionary zoning that kept minority communities out of those suburban communities, and then a sort of a new history where we're finding that those suburban communities are now becoming increasingly unaffordable for everyone. So what happened? So where are we? We have exclusionary zoning, which has put us in a position where we have a very segregated region. We have declining housing production. We have slow response to demographic shifts. We're seeing a lot of change in preferences and in our demographics in our suburbs. And it's no wonder that we're in a crisis. This is really just one thing now on top of the other. To go through a few of those points, you know, just to really drive the point home, if you look at this chart, you'll see New York region is the most segregated region in the country. And this really, you know, has a lot of impacts, a lot of effects. There's just disparity, economic and social disparity, unequal access to good schools, and quality housing. And this map, I think, really says a lot. You know, you can we had done some really interesting mapping for the fourth plan work, where you could see very clearly that our poor communities in our cities, low-income minority communities, are underperforming, and you have your wealthier suburban communities that have high-ranking schools, and this plays out over and over again in our region. I mean, this pattern reinforces disparity and it impacts economic opportunity. And really, in order to diversify our communities, what we really are talking about is we need to diversify our housing stock. We need more housing choice in our suburban communities. I mean, this slide is very interesting in that it just shows us, you know, out of housing that was built between 1950 and 1959, and that housing that's still around today, there's 1 million units of older 1950-style housing. In contrast, between 2000 and 2009, we only built 430,000 new units in total. And just to, you know, put a point on that, this recent uptick in multifamily construction, we have seen multifamily construction, but it's just not enough. We're anticipating about 64,000 new units over the next 15 years or so, but that really, it's just less than half of what we're projecting that we need to have. We had done some work at RPA with HRNA as part of the Long Island Index, and I think what we're seeing in Long Island is something you're seeing in suburban communities, you know, across our region. And then there's also the changing preferences. We've been hearing a lot about this today. Everybody's talking about the different preferences of our baby boomers, our millennials. They're looking for more walkable, compact communities. And yes, a lot of that is going to the cities, but they're also looking for a more walkable suburb. You know, there's just a different way people are conceiving of what the suburbs might look like in the future. And when you talk to people today who are living in the suburbs, we did some survey work again on the fourth plan and asked people, you know, if they were optimistic about the future, something, you know, we all talked about this morning in the plenary session or before the plenary session. You know, there was actually a much less lack of optimism amongst folks that we had polled in the suburbs than we found in this room today, and even than you're finding in the cities. You know, less than a quarter of people were really feeling positive about the future of the suburban communities. So what are we going to do about this? Where are we going? Oh, and you know, one other point I wanted to say, sorry, before I flipped off that slide, about the suburbs, I wanted to also underscore that it's not just housing, that this is really a cross-cutting issue, because when you look at the suburban pattern, we're also seeing a lot of slippage in our commercial development in the suburbs as well, where we have commercial office park vacancies, and we have, you know, really changing preferences of not just where people live and where they work, and those things are very much related. And it's important to note, especially in our region, very recently with GE leaving, from going from suburban Fairfield, going to Boston's Seaport District. So that is another important point I wanted to hit on there. But so where are we going? What are we going to do about this? You know, how do we support suburban growth? And what are our goals? We're not talking about, you know, remaking the suburbs entirely and dismantling single-family neighborhoods. We're really talking about what we can do to develop a more modern suburb, a suburb that's more equitable, it's more affordable, it's walkable, it's more accessible. And what are the tools, you know, that we need to get us there? So we talk about a few different things, and I'm going to go through these individually, so I'm not going to sort of read through the list now, but we're talking about a combination of carrots and sticks. You know, what are the incentives that we can put out there to encourage people to do build affordable housing, to plan for affordable housing in the right places? And then also, what sort of mandates, you know, do we need to really be thinking about to encourage folks who are really not so interested in communities that maybe are not really ready necessarily to move on this, but we need to move on this, so how do we encourage that to happen? And finally, we're proposing that the state really take a much bigger role, that the three states take a much bigger role in all of this. So the first idea that we're putting out there is on the incentive side, you know, really helping municipalities, technical assistance to municipalities to plan for multifamily, increased density around transit in downtowns, in growth areas, and what financial incentives we can put into place to really encourage that to happen, incentives to help municipalities adopt new zoning. And there's been some great stuff happening in Massachusetts, which I'm sure we'll talk about, where, you know, in addition to incentivizing to implement the zoning, also incentivizing construction of built units. Something else to think about. In addition, ways to expedite permitting for multifamily development, and also preferences in discretionary funding for infrastructure improvements that would support the kind of development we'd like to see to improve affordable housing and create more multifamily housing. And then also addressing municipal costs. And I want to frame this a little bit to say, you know, there's a lot of concern among communities about what does this mean for the suburbs. If we have, you know, multifamily development, if we have more density, if we have affordable housing, what does this look like for us? And a lot of people, you know, raise the alarm, well, we're going to have too many school kids and our infrastructure doesn't have the capacity to handle it. And what we're saying with these policies is that, you know, some of those things are real concerns, real infrastructure that, you know, needs to be funded. Others, you know, maybe in some places it's true that, you know, you're generating a lot of school children. Maybe it's not so true in other places, and maybe it's more of a NIMBY argument. But regardless, that if we can put together a package of municipal San Jose municipal funding to support infrastructure that's needed, that helps us move the needle forward on this. And then on the other side, where we were talking about state mandates, really saying, you know, listen, these are affordable housing goals that are going to be set statewide, and we'll talk about in a minute different ways that we might approach those housing goals. And then, you know, how we help municipalities, again, going back to incentives, help folks, you know, get to those goals, requiring an affordable housing plan, but then also providing technical assistance and funding to develop that plan so it can get adopted. And then requiring affordable housing in new developments, which New York City successfully has done very recently. We heard this morning about the mandatory inclusionary housing program and encouraging more of that around the region. And finally, sort of a simple one, but you know, another one that maybe you know not so welcome initially, but could really make a big difference, is allowing for accessory units in single-family neighborhoods. That could create a whole new amount of affordable housing, sort of without really changing the character in certain neighborhoods and single-family neighborhoods. And so we'll talk today, and I'll leave this more for the panelists to discuss, but about different ways that we might do these things. You know, there's different existing state models. There's the fair share approach, which California, New Jersey, and Minnesota have taken, where it's a statewide allocation of units to municipalities, and municipalities are on the hook to provide the units that are distributed to them. You know, sort of an upside there. Obviously, it's much more tailored to the local conditions. It's not sort of just this across-the-board requirement. On the other hand, it can be really politically fraught in trying to come up with those allocations. We've seen that happen in New Jersey. And then the other option, and there's maybe more that I'm excited to hear that the panelists might have to share with us today, but another one that's been done, you know, locally in Connecticut and Massachusetts is setting a state minimum across the board that there is a goal and everybody's working to achieve that goal with housing plans that tell us how we're going to get towards it. And then, you know, it's really important, we can't forget, there's one thing to create affordable housing, but on the other side, you know, it's very important that we also work on addressing discrimination, housing discrimination, which is very real, that we provide more funding for testing, that there's, you know, opportunities that we can get people out there in the field, you know, have two folks from different racial, ethnic backgrounds go and try and rent or buy the same home or apartment, and, you know, really expose what's going on. I think it's very important we all know that people are more compliant about things when they know that they're being watched and monitored, and sort of, you know, if people feel that enforcement is lax, then things get lax. And then also I think there's a new opportunity that, again, will be interesting to hear from the panelists to really improve community planning and maybe using the new AFFH rule to do that more, so we can talk about that today as well. I mean, finally, the thing I'd like to end with that I think really, you know, kind of brings all these pieces together is we need to educate communities. We need to work with communities to help them understand, you know, what we're really talking about for the suburbs. If we don't do more and build more affordable housing, more multifamily housing, provide some more density in transit sort of locations, you know, what does that really look like? Is it really sustainable for the suburban parts of our region to continue to have single-family homes on two-acre lots? Is that really going to, you know, be the best economics for those municipalities? And to understand the compact, you know, the benefits of compact growth, the benefits of diversity, having a diverse community, diverse school, what those real benefits are, and helping to quantify those benefits so people can really, you know, put a number to it and start to understand and change that conversation. And I was really, you know, excited when I heard County Executive Blown this morning say, you know, exactly what I knew I was going to say at the end, which was showcase best practices, show us, you know, show us what works, and let's replicate those models. So that's the overview presentation of RPA's ideas. I'm going to now turn it back to Ingrid and the panel to discuss them and give us your thoughts, and look forward to the conversation.
Terrific. Thank you, Melissa. That's a great setup and a lot to talk about there. So I'm going to start with, I think, asking, and Melissa, you should feel free to jump in too, but for all of you, I guess maybe this is everybody but Chris. who are from this region, where are the key shortages in the region in terms of multifamily? Is it multifamily housing? Is it affordable housing? Is it the largely white suburbs? I mean, where are the real shortages? And I don't know if we want to just take the down the line.
Yeah, I'm happy to start from the New Jersey perspective. What year is this, 2016? If you'd gone back pre-recession, you might have said that it was a shortage of multifamily. But it's really a shortage of affordable, because particularly in the last five, 6 years, the multifamily construction has been enormous. It's been way more than a majority, but it's high priced. And the rental demand from the millennials and frankly all age groups has really jumped. So it's to me, it's way more than just multifamily. It's really affordability. I mean, now, you know, Jersey City is, you know, is the new Brooklyn. I mean, they're actually marketing themselves as an alternative. Everybody's being an alternative to Manhattan now. Brooklyn, Queens, Jersey City. Hoboken was ahead of Jersey City. Jersey City is, but that's not really a suburb. The suburbs now are having similar issues, just slightly lower rents. But to me, and we can amplify on this later, but it's way more than just a need for more multifamily.
And is there multifamily housing being built throughout the region suburbs? Is it concentrated in the more urbanized suburbs?
You know, in my former life, I worked for a very big home builder. And big home builders today are no longer building the McMansions. I mean, a little bit, but for the most part, that is not the preferred market. So it's small lots. Small lots singles is very desirable. Luxury townhouses, very desirable. Luxury rentals, very desirable.
Luxury condos,
very desirable. So it's not the sprawl that we did for 50 years. Yeah. That's not what it is anymore.
Jamie, what would you say?
I can't tell if this is... Hey, there we go. You know, clearly, I would agree about affordability in the region that we work in. We work statewide, but if I understand correctly, the region that we're talking about here doesn't extend beyond sort of Lower Hudson. I think it's sort of what we're talking about, right? Lower Hudson Valley. So, but I mean, we see the same things increasingly in some of the upstate cities we work in. Definitely affordability, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that as we go on. Some of the statistics that I think you showed in your slide presentation about rent burden in the region are obviously very telling. So there's your affordability crisis. I guess one other thing I would say, and I'm going to come back to this, I think maybe a little later, as we talk about ways to attack the crisis, whatever the crisis is, also suitability. So the housing stock is something that I think we probably don't talk, the quality of the housing stock is probably something that we don't talk enough about when we're talking about the housing crisis in this region. And it's something that we're very much focusing on at HCR is, if only because of for reasons of efficiency, what can we do to push preservation versus simply looking in the area of new construction? I mean, we've got at HCR, for example, we have statewide but 200,000 units of affordable housing that we've helped develop over the last X number of years, and a lot of those, you know, they're obviously every year that goes by, they're increasingly in need of refinancing and repair. That's something that we're focusing on, not just in our portfolio, but when other people come into us with, whether it's a Section 8 program, project, or HUD 202 or whatever, we are open for business and preservation as well.
But you also feel like there's a fair amount of multifamily. You feel like multifamily development is happening, but not affordable.
That's
the key issue. So.
Not enough, clearly. Yeah.
And Elaine?
I would say a couple of different things. First of all, the multifamily is necessary to achieve affordability when you have very high costs, like the cost of land, et cetera. So it does need to be multifamily, and it needs to be affordable at a variety of price points. But the broader point that I would make is that the way we frame this discussion is very important. And we had a great presentation, but what I didn't hear there was that when the suburbs were created, they were created intentionally to be racially segregated. And that has such an impact, continues to have such an impact, the fact that there were racial covenants in the deeds that really made it so that someone that looked like me would not be able to access that cheap, that inexpensive housing in Levittown, et cetera. And it's not just that it was significant in the past, but it embedded a development, a housing development pattern that determined who would have access to what resources. And so we have to be intentional now to make sure that we're not just talking about affordable housing, but we're talking about where is the affordable housing placed. If you could put the slide up. Where is the affordable housing placed? So just as a quick example, sometimes visual is more helpful. You know, we looked very closely at the housing that is supported through the low-income housing tax credits. And only 16%, this is on Long Island, only 16% of the units have three or more bedrooms. And that's why there's only one little dark house up there and the others are light. Only 48% of the units are studios or one-bedroom apartments. 66% of the units are in neighborhoods in which over 40% of the population is black and or Latino, and many are in majority black and or Latino. Again, we're talking about access to high-quality schools, for example. We have 66% of the units are in low-performing, high-need public schools. 62% of the units are in low or very low-income neighborhoods. 33% of the units are clustered in racially segregated areas of high-opportunity neighborhoods. So this pattern, which is has been the pattern for decades, it will continue unless we intentionally say that that is not good enough, unless we say that we really have to be, from a practical standpoint, about inclusion, about access to opportunity, that we have to embrace the notion that there are benefits to racial diversity. It's not something we should be pulling away from. Yes, the region is becoming more diverse, but when we look closely on Long Island, it's not becoming less racially segregated in any significant way, and our schools are becoming more segregated, as a matter of fact. So it is we absolutely need the affordable housing, but we absolutely need to do it in a way that stops some of these trends that we've seen for decades will continue without the intervention.
Yeah. Well, no, and I appreciate that. And I do want to underscore, I mean, one of the reasons this Melissa showed that, you know, New York City is now, that New York metro area, I think, is the third most segregated region of the country. I think we're behind Detroit and it's Milwaukee, yes. I'm not in good company there. But part of it is that all these other regions have seen reductions in segregation. And New York it's been very, very sticky.
Persistent.
Very persistent. And what I'm curious about is whether if you looked at the development of multifamily units in general, sort of market rate multifamily, do you think you would see similar patterns on Long Island? Is a lot of the multifamily housing in general been concentrated? Or it sounds like in New Jersey, you're seeing more kind of higher end multifamily that's now coming into whiter communities, higher income communities.
Yeah, I mean, it's coming Go ahead.
I'm sorry. The thing about multifamily on Long Island, it's not that that the higher end doesn't get built, but the higher end gets built with with effort, because there is you don't find multifamily housing as of right. So whether the project, certainly if the project is affordable housing, there are myriad reasons why it's not going to get built. But there's even pushback for more market rate.
Housing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to come back to that. But first, Catherine, can you tell us about Connecticut?
Sure. Let me set the stage to contextualize Connecticut inside of this conversation. So the bulk of the housing that was created in Connecticut was created after 1970 for obviously very different demographic. Over 70% of towns developed 40% or more of their housing after 1970. So that's resulted in an unnatural dependence on single-family home ownership, right? Two-thirds of towns are at least 70% or more single-family, and that's on the low end. There are many towns that are 90, 98% single-family home ownership. So the lack of multifamily housing and rental housing is very real and very severe. And then we see that play out on the demand side for affordable housing. When you look at the housing wage and you compare that to all the occupations in Connecticut, half of those occupations don't earn enough to afford to rent a basic two-bedroom apartment. Mm-hmm. 50% of renters and 1 in 3 homeowners are spending more than 30% of their income on their housing, and that's unsustainable. So when you look at the land use patterns of growth, mm-hmm. most of the affordable housing is concentrated in our cities. Just 32 of our towns have 10% or more affordable housing. And so this all has, you know, two public policy effects that I'd highlight. And the first that Elaine alluded to, and so did Melissa, is the lack of housing choices for low and moderate income people. So they're limited where they can live and best suited for their families. So limited in terms of education, access to employment, transit, and services. And then on the municipal side, it has a very real fiscal effect. So we've looked at the real property grand list for towns. And we have 169 towns in Connecticut. From 2008 to 2013, 155 towns, real property grand list, were flat or had fallen. So there's a very significant bottom line effect that the lack of housing diversity has.
Yeah. So, Chris, I think you mentioned sort of looking at sort of demographic projections and thinking about. So I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit. I know the Joint Center does a lot of demographic work.
Sure.
And forecasting, and what are the demographic shifts that you think? I mean, it sounds like we're already behind, mm-hmm. but how far behind are we going to be in 25 years in terms of matching mismatch with the population and the housing stock?
Sure. So there are really two broad demographic trends that are happening that are going to shape housing demand going forward, and the big one is the aging of the baby boom generation. And so there's a lot been made about the fact that since 2010, 10,000 boomers are turning 65 every year. And so we're at a point now where the boomers between now and 2020 are moving into that 65 to 75 demographic. 2020, they start turning 75. And then in 2030, they start turning 85. And if you look at growth in households, net change in households by age, we project between 13 and 14 million over the next 10 years. A big chunk of that are going to be people who are over age 65 and ultimately over age 75. So aging the population is going to be huge. The other big thrust, obviously, demographically, is the millennial generation, the largest generation that we've had to date. It's bigger already than the baby boom generation at the same age, and it's being augmented by immigration all the time, so getting bigger. And so that's another big wave coming through. The key thing about the millennial generation is its diversity. And so racially, it's, you know, majority-minority. And so we're shifting. That other big piece of demand is going to be a increasingly racially and ethnically diverse group. And so you have those two big phenomena. And they're linked, I think, ultimately in terms of demand. So if you think about that's the who. What does that mean in terms of what? And so for the baby boomers, part of that, when you look at the age, the household composition of growth, you'll find that there's tremendous growth in single-person and two-person households. So some people look at that and say, we need to build a lot more multifamily housing. Part of the problem is that we only need to build it if we get the baby boomers out of the houses they're in now. And people express a desire to age in place, and for the most part, they follow through on that. So if you look at people 80 and over, 60% have been in their home for more than 20 years. Another 20% have been there 10 to 19. So most people are choosing where they're going to live when they're in their 50s and 60s. And so, but the question isn't that, you know, there's a lot of talk about supporting aging in place. We like to talk about aging in community. And the notion is that people, those social ties are important. But that housing unit itself, they're probably overhoused. It's probably not the right physical layout for them.
It's probably not accessible. Right?
It's not accessible. And as they get to be 85 and no longer drive. So, I mean, to Melissa's point, I think if we picture these kind of suburban town centers that have walkability, part of that we think about the millennials, but actually it could be for older households who can stay in their community and turn over that single-family house. Because I do think we underestimate the demand for millennials, I think, ultimately for single-family living and suburban living. There's a reason why that was appealing. I mean, certainly certainly urban areas revitalizing this morning panel about what's going to happen in cities, but we're going to have a both end. The cities are going to grow, but there's also going to be the growing affordability issues in the city and for other reasons, people moving to the suburbs. So this picture of walkable downtowns, I think we need to create those that are age-friendly. They'll be good for millennials who want more affordable housing, but they'll also be good for older households who then free up that housing for the next generation as well. So I think, you know, there's still going to be a lot of growth in the suburbs, and I think the key is making it accessible for a broad range of age groups, and also I think changing the mindset of baby boomers to think about moving to be able to free up that housing.
Well, I think that may be for another panel, but I think it's a fascinating question to think sort of what policy can do to encourage people upon retirement maybe to move out of their home. homes. Although we know that living in an inaccessible home, actually, you're more likely to fall. You're more likely to get injured. You're likely to enter, assisted living earlier.
Right. And so, I think the key, we sell that vision. It has to be not just for people from outside, but people from the community. It helps make it more politically.
Right.
And you also have to get people to buy into it earlier, because by the time you get to be 80, the ability to move is much less.
Let me add on that, because it's an interesting dilemma, and it's for people that have been in a house for decades, 10, 20, 30 years, they're probably debt-free or darn close to it. But that's the vast majority of their wealth. And there's this resistance to sell at recession-impacted prices is real. My neighbor sold his house in 2005, and I'm holding out for that. You know, maybe someday that'll happen, but
that's really slowing down the market.
And the second piece of that, though, is that the millennials or the next generation up, it's not their preferred architecture. It's not their preferred lot size. It's not their preferred. And so that also reduces prices. So you have this sort of static situation where they want to get the price. Other factors are saying they're not going to get the price. And so they're staying. They're staying because they like the community and stuff. So getting that log jam going is going to be a challenge.
So I want to talk about barriers to to making these suburban walkable downtowns, to building more multifamily affordable housing. And what do you think, if I can ask you to quickly go through, what do you think the three key barriers are in our region suburbs to getting more affordable and more multifamily housing built?
Three words: zoning, and zoning.
Okay.
I mean, I really think in the end,
it's
that. And part of the problem is the decision makers, the town mothers and fathers and the planning board members and those people are people like me. I mean, they're people who are in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, been around. They're thinking of themselves. They're thinking about getting reelected. And they're not thinking about the future constituents, who are the millennials and the Generation X and the Generation Y. Mm-hmm. And so they're not prone to making those forward-looking decisions that are going to benefit the town, because, my gosh, it might actually raise taxes to have to do some of these things. I know I can't get reelected if I do that. So this sort of self-interest in staying in office and protecting the status quo needs to yield.
It's the home voters.
And I really think look, there's lots of good literature out there on the right way to do the zoning and the right way to do all that stuff. They're not buying it yet.
Yeah.
So some people are, but I don't think enough are yet.
Yeah. And Chris?
So I think it's three things. I think it's...
Are you going to say zoning?
Yeah,
zoning,
you're going to say...
No, I'm not. I'm going to say schools, traffic, and the other. I think it's a fear about, we're going to get high density, it's going to bring traffic, it's going to change the character of our town. If you have family-friendly housing, it's going to bring in more people to populate the schools. That's expensive. And then underneath all that is the other, that they're building this housing for people coming from the city.
Or don't look like me.
They don't look like me. And so I think you have to address each of those. And some of them you may not be able to address. You may just have to find ways to, open up the town. But I think schools, traffic, and the other.
Right. Some of it you can get through education, some through funding, some through...
Something that you just have to force change.
Well, we'll talk more about that. So, Jamie, what do you think?
This sort of underpins a lot, and these are obviously all deeply interrelated. Cost is clearly an issue, at least in this region, and I assume it's true in Connecticut too, but certainly anywhere we work. And there are a lot of things that get built into cost. There's certainly zoning is a cost. I mean, time is money. Just the cost of, there's a lot of things, big factors built into cost. But I think in some ways, and I think this also factors into something that RPA has written about in their plan, is governance, structures of governance. So New York, as everybody knows, is a very strong home rule state. And that plays out in places like Long Island, particularly where, when you take one step over the line, you're in a different village, a different township, a different city, maybe all at the same time. And you're certainly in a different school district, which has its own complications. With different financing, models, financing that is decoupled from the concerns that the other pieces of the governance structure have. So it certainly makes it at a minimum difficult and expensive to navigate, and it also empowers some of the I think makes it enables some of the issues that
the NIMBYism,
or just zoning, even if it's just inertia. Anything takes time.
Yeah, but you're saying it's actually more costly for developers to have to figure out, navigate all these different systems.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, so I don't have to use as one of my three what's already been said, which is zoning, which I agree with.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's fair. That's
tricky, huh?
Yeah, no, that's fair.
And also this issue of governance. Yeah. Well, I'm going to say a little bit more about governance, but let me mention infrastructure, because on Long Island, in Suffolk County anyway, sometimes sewers are a real impediment to multifamily, any kind of dense housing. And so I would also say that transportation is a problem. It's not that it would stop the housing from being built, but it makes the housing less than what it might be, less effective than it might be, because it's not there. But the other one that I want to mention that is not has not been talked about so much is there are a million myths that, and I'm not going to say that can just contribute to NIMBYism, because that has a connotation that that somehow the NIMBYs are less educated, or they're not, you know, they're not in the know or whatever. I'm talking about otherwise intelligent individuals who are professionals, et cetera. They also believe the myths about, we're going to have so many children and this is what's going to happen to our school, even though we've had research has been done by the LAA and by other institutions, you know, across the country, that you get more families with the single-family home than you do with these apartments. But, you know, the myth lives on. There's another very embedded one, which has to do with the first comment I made today, and that is that inherently, if you have African-Americans and Hispanics moving into your community, that your property values are going to go down. And that's a whole nother panel discussion about how people can point to, truthfully, people can point to some instances where they used to know this community, it was like X, and, you know, a decade later, this community has changed, you know, demographic, and it's like Y. But they don't understand how did it get from X to Y.
Anecdotes are very powerful.
It's a complicated, it's a much more complicated answer, but that really keeps a lot of affordable housing, it's a real impediment to affordable housing out on Long Island. And the, just the other little bit from my third related to governance, we just made comments to an analysis of impediments. I won't mention for what municipality, but believe it or not, no, this is not the state, I can say that. Good. It's not the state. Since you're on the panel with me, I left those comments in my back pocket.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
But I will say that the analysis basically said that, you know, public policy, zoning, local opposition, they're not really impediments to affordable housing. And if you look at, and, you know, if you want to know where it is, please speak to me, because you can go look at the AI yourself. I mean, the analysis, and in some cases, there's no data to support these kinds of things, or the analysis is so bogus that it's any student could look at it and see what the problems are. So I think that we need our public officials to take very seriously these planning documents and use it as an opportunity. It's not an exercise, you know, for silliness, but an opportunity to really say, we want our community to be something else in the future. Let's look with, let's be clear-eyed about what the real impediments are and how are we going to address that.
Yeah, no, and it sounds like those of us who are on the research side should be making sure to get the research out there that there still are gaps in understanding and knowledge, so.
Sure. So I think I'll echo a lot of what my panelists said, but I'll add a bit more to it. One lack of zoning. I have three and a half. One lack of zoning. And in Connecticut, we have 23 towns that prohibit multifamily housing. 122 towns require a special permit. 18 towns require 5 or more acres for multifamily housing. That's on the zoning side. On the infrastructure side, we have many towns that lack sewer and water. These are not towns just out in the hinterlands. These are towns that have train stations that are on commuter lines. So we need to think about a regulatory environment that allows development in an environmentally sensitive way that when you don't have the sewers or water there. And then the third is on the local level, and I think this is the most important. One of the towns don't understand well enough why housing diversity is in their interest, and they're afraid of it. And we can see that that will stop a development in its tracks. I mean, even with the most supportive governor and administration of affordable housing in Connecticut in the last 30 years, it can, with all the resources that's been committed, local fear can stop a project in its tracks. Once you get over that hump, there's still the lack of understanding of how to develop the multifamily housing, because these towns haven't had to do it for 40 years. We have part-time town planners. We have towns that don't have planners. So even when they want to do it, they don't know how to get there. And that's why we have 169 housing data profiles. That's why we do all of our education. That's why last week we had a multifamily speed dating event where we brought in town planners with regional developers.
That's awesome.
Because they still don't know how to take that next step.
Yeah, that's interesting. So their capacity constraints. Well, you know, we've got a lot of students graduating in urban planning from the region, so we'll send them your way. So, and I definitely want to come back to this point about the outright bans on multifamily housing and how that possibly doesn't violate the Fair Housing Act. But anyway, but we'll come back to that.
I didn't say they were constitutional, but they're still there.
So, but Jamie, let's talk a little bit. I want to shift to really, we've been talking about the problems. I want to shift to the solutions. And Jamie, maybe start with you to think. I mean, you emphasize the challenge of government fragmentation in the region, but. But thinking, you sit in state government, and so I know you think about this, and what tools do state governments have to tackle some of these barriers and help to encourage more affordable and multifamily housing?
Sure. And
what's HCR doing, I guess?
Okay, sure. I don't want to, it'll take too long for me to get through all of them. On the one hand, we have a multitude of tools. You know, there's sort of more and less available to us depending.
Well, let's focus on the effective ones.
Okay, great. Money is always, I think, the most effective, right? So,
yeah.
There's money and there's enforcement, and then there's, we call it suasion of one kind or another. Mm-hmm. Our agency is not much in the enforcement business, so I'll, for the most part, stay away from that. Mm-hmm. Our enforcement efforts are mostly concentrated in the area of rent stabilization in the city. We oversee the 900,000 rent stabilized units in New York City. We do enforcement there. Beyond that, we have some nascent fair housing enforcement that we will talk about later probably. The principal tool that we have at HCR is money. We are the largest issuer of affordable housing bonds. We're the tax and bond issuer for the state for the development of affordable housing. We have Sunny Mae, which is a single family mortgage agency. We have a very under-recognized tool, the Mortgage Insurance Fund, which insures mostly multifamily mortgages for development, which we use for policy purposes as well. So we've got all those tools. We also have a number of very effective and, again, somewhat under-recognized grant programs that we use more, again, outside of this region, because in this region, New York City has its own many tools that are like that, but certainly in Long Island, Upper Westchester, and so forth, we're active. They range from home ownership, counseling, grants for home ownership counseling agencies, rehab, some senior rehab programs that are very effective, those kinds of things. Let me focus on a couple that I think relate back to something we just talked about. We have two programs that are really interesting and relatively new. One is called Main Street, and one is the Community Investment Fund. They emerged in the last couple of years under Governor Cuomo, and they are at this point sort of a signal part of our community renewal, the community renewal part of our mission. They are targeted specifically to downtown revitalization. They have nothing to do except tangentially with housing. They don't go specifically to development of housing for the most part. But they've been enormously effective in creating communities that are conducive to sticky housing. And I'll give you an example. I, to- I um, spent time traveling around the southern tier of the state, again, outside of the region, but its problems are the same, a couple months ago with a state senator who represents a good portion of the southern tier of the state. And we've put a lot of our Main Street money into some of the small, struggling rural areas, rural towns in there. And we have specifically targeted things like storefront revitalization. So, you know, street furniture, you know, fixing up storefronts that have really been run down over the last 40, 50 years, and what are really historic, beautiful buildings that just aren't attractive anymore. $100,000 in a place like Mount Morris goes an incredibly long way. And by the time you get spending $100,000 here, $100,000 there, in a year, you've got a very attractive downtown that now can attract and retain tourism and new, and small businesses. And what's happened as a result is we've enabled people to come in, start retails, and then we've also found ways to direct money to the affordable housing above the retail. So now you've got a thriving downtown over three blocks mm-hmm. where 5 years ago you had absolutely yeah. nothing. So
which hopefully will sort of trigger some market
investment. Exactly. And it's, we've done it because we've looked at, we've taken sort of a yeah. holistic approach to these areas where we are the only game in town. It creates walkability, allows people to stay in the town, creates strong neighborhoods, things like that, as opposed mm-hmm. to, you know, draining an entire downtown. Mm-hmm. So those are some of our more effective tools. I mean, obviously I'm not lingering on low-income housing tax credits, which in the end are most right. impactful.
Right. Okay. Well, let me move to talk a little bit about, let's say, turn back to zoning and talk a little bit about what we have learned from, I'd like to hear what you think we have learned from the fair share requirements in New Jersey or the minimum affordable housing thresholds in Connecticut and Massachusetts. And I don't know, Peter, you're a New Jersey expert.
New Jersey has been, with the Mount Laurel first did in the mid-70s, I guess right. it was already. Slow start, Fair Housing Act 1983, creation of the Council on Affordable Housing 1985. From 1985 till the early 2000s, progress was actually made. You can agree or disagree on how much progress, but there were around 60,000 units created. Mm-hmm. Most of those probably would not have been created without that. The problem is, since then, really since 2004 until now, everything has been tied up in litigation. I could spend an hour telling you the whole story, but the bottom line is towns were resistant. The Council on Affordable Housing and what they call the third round rules dramatically modified the approach that had been court approved for the two previous rounds, ended up in litigation. And it took literally 10 years to resolve that. And just March of last year, the New Jersey Supreme Court had had enough. And they said, the Council on Affordable Housing, you're out of business. You have not lived up to your statutory obligations. We are turning the solutions back to the trial courts. Mm-hmm. Now, I, as I've been in this game for over 30 years, I was sure that when they did that, the state legislature would jump in, just as they did in 1983. They haven't. Wow. So now we have all 21 counties with trials going to be happening in the next 6 months on each town's individual fair share numbers. It's horrible. And so nothing has basically happened in the last 10, 11 years.
Yeah.
It's just been horrible. And what gets me, it gets to this point, the towns, because it's not politically expedient to say, bring us affordable housing, because the reasons I said before, are doing nothing, except for the minimum they have to do with the court case. And they're going to do nothing until they get finally judicially determined fair share number for their town. Once that gets set, then they will be forced to start to comply. We will have lost a dozen or more years.
Yeah.
And there's a huge
And meanwhile,
battle.
There's a lot of development going on that's 100% market rate.
There was a tremendous amount of, I mean, you know, up until 08, 09, right. when the recession hit, there was, you know, you saw the charts, it
right.
was less than it was in the 50s and 60s, but still, you know, 40, 50,000 units a year. Virtually none of that affordable, and during the recession, very, you know, 10, 15,000 units a year. But now there's stuff going on. A lot of it, as I said, is multifamily, but it's luxury multifamily. It's not affordable. So land has been eaten up, opportunities have been lost. And
cautionary note about litigation.
Cautionary short about fair share statutes.
Yeah. So let's talk about, Massachusetts 40B, and now I'm going to forget, Catherine, sorry, the Connecticut 80 something, right?
830G.
Seems similar.
What
very
is it?
Similar, but
830G.
Yeah. 830G.
But do you want to talk about what has been the? Do you want to explain a little bit about how that works, and are there lessons that we should be learning in this region from that?
So Massachusetts Chapter 40B was passed in 1969, and it's a much simpler process where they basically say that the town has to have 10% of the housing units have to be affordable to people making 80% of area median income or less, and if you don't. And a developer brings a development into town that would have 20 to 25% of the units affordable, and you don't approve it, then they have a process to bring it to the state to appeal, saying that you haven't met your affordable housing requirements, and therefore you have
But if a developer comes with 100% market rate with no affordable,
you're
below your requirement. Does it have to have at least 10%?
It has to have an affordable component.
So it's basically like a mandatory inclusionary zoning program if you haven't met your minimum.
I'm sorry, it's not inclusion in the sense that a developer can come and propose to do a 100% of, not a market rate as long as the town approve it.
So what the developer can do is
they can also use that as a stick, right, to say, approve my development or I'll make it an affordable housing development and I'll take you 40B. So there's ways in which it can produce more housing that's not affordable because of the threat of overriding local
zoning. And so what do you think what has been the result? Has it resulted just in multifamily housing then, that these developers have used it as a stick but they haven't actually built affordable housing?
Well, it's produced, certainly even if it produces higher density housing, right, that can be a win, right?
Yep.
It's been in place since 1969. There's still a whole host of places that haven't come close. I think out of the 312 cities and towns in Massachusetts, about 40 or 42 have reached the 10% threshold, so a little more than 10%. So more than 90% haven't. Mm-hmm. So there's been slow progress towards it. So I think in some sense it's not that stringent, which has allowed it to stick around. There was a statewide ballot initiative to rescind it a few years ago. And it was defeated with a comfortable margin. I think because of the fact that probably it isn't as severe, made it that it still had a number of supporters. And so, but I think to the point
of
the
environmentalists, are they supportive or what?
Environmentalists,
not their issue.
They
don't see it as their issue.
Yeah, I haven't seen that as much of opposition. But to my earlier comments, one of the things the state has done as of 10 years ago, they realized that there's a stick there, they needed more of a carrot. So they passed companion legislation, 40R and 40S.
Right.
And 40R says if a town puts a zoning overlay district that is higher density, has 20 to 25% affordable, is transit oriented, then the state will pay them a fee for having just created that. And it has to be as-of-right zoning within that district. And so it has to be 8 units per acre for single-family, 12 for kind of townhouses, and 20 for multifamily. And as-of-right, then you can get fees up to $600,000 from the state for just creating that district. And then for every unit that actually gets permitted, you get another $3,000. So providing a financial incentive for towns to create as-of-right, higher-density, transit-oriented development. Since 2005, 13,000 units have been planned as part of that. 3,000 have actually been built. And along with that, there's 40S, which says
many communities have taken advantage, though?
It's about 35.
Okay.
There's some of the communities are taking advantage of it who are kind of historically lower-income communities, but a bunch of those are communities that have not hit their 10% threshold. Okay. Belmont, Marblehead.
Do they insulate themselves then from 40B
challenges? They do it themselves. No, this is the town driven.
Okay.
And it's part of the way of saying, okay, if we're going to have to get to our 10%, let's do it. Where we want it, when we want it. Let's get money for it. Then 40S says, if you build housing units and you take the kind of typical amount of the property taxes generated by that unit, take the typical amount that goes to schools. If that's not enough to pay for the school kids that come out of it, the state will give you money to make up the difference. So they give you financial incentives to create higher density, and they give you financial incentive to pay for the schooling. Mm-hmm. One of the challenges has been that they haven't created a steady enough funding source. Right now is a trust fund for it that generates revenue from sale of state property. Mm-hmm. And now that they're starting to get more use of it, there's some concern that communities look at it and say, there's no money there, so if I do this, will I get paid? Mm-hmm. So they're trying to create a more stable source of funding mm-hmm. to make sure that there's a pot of money that lures town to do it.
And what about Connecticut? I mean, you have the similar set now, right, of the same minimum threshold and then the incentives.
And full disclosure, we were inspired by Massachusetts.
Yes.
look that way.
Our A30G, which is our builder's remedy, was enacted in 1989. It allows developers to come into towns that don't have 10% of their housing affordable mm-hmm. to develop a mixed income project or affordable project. We have a 30% set aside, half of that at 80% AMI, half at 60% AMI. And towns can't overturn that. Towns have to allow that so long as it doesn't compromise health or safety. Mm-hmm. And then it shifts the burden of proof using the courts onto the towns as opposed to the developer if that becomes appealed. So in 25 years, it's created thousands of units. It's hard to track. There are also examples of towns that say, you know, to a developer, come in using 830G. It's not politically palatable right now. I have to run next year. And that happens too, so it's a difficult one to track in terms of a unit outcome. But there's also a respite mechanism that I don't think gets highlighted enough. So if a town has 2% of its housing as affordable, it can achieve a moratorium. So developers can't come in for 4 years, and it's achievable. We see it in the RPA region. Darien has achieved one. Wilton, Richfield, New Canaan is on its way to achieving moratorium, and that's really important to highlight. And then the third part, it's worth highlighting inside of the statute is that we didn't always have the most supportive administration of housing. We didn't always have the resources that we did, but 830G was still working because it didn't require funding. It didn't require a council that could be disbanded. It relied on the courts. Inside of doing that, it also evolved, you know, really well-established precedent over 25 years. So, you know, developers, land use attorneys, towns have really clear guidance inside of this issue.
So can I ask a question about this? This is a little touchy in New York City right now, but the city is being sued about their community preference policy for affordable housing that they set aside. Half of the units are set aside and given the local residents of the community board are given preference to live in those units. And I'm wondering, in a lot of these cases, are there, and I know in Massachusetts, right, there are community preferences in place, but I know there's some buffering of that for fair housing concerns. But sort of who's living in these units? Is this truly opening up the suburbs, or is it the local community? So in an all-white area, are the families that are moving in and the households moving in largely white? Do we know anything about that?
I don't know the answer to that. I think there's 70% local preference allowed.
70%, that's really high. Yeah.
There can't be local preference in the units that are created.
They're openly marketed, affirmatively marketed?
Absolutely. Right. They have to comply like any other development with fair housing laws. And then I would also just highlight the counterpart that to 40R that we have, which is the incentive housing zone program. Mm-hmm. And so that's a proactive planning grant. A series of grants that towns can achieve, small grants, $20,000, $50,000, to really look at their housing stock outside of the scenario of we have a development on the table, let's act now to stop it. So they can proactively look at what are their housing needs, understand why affordable housing is inside their interests, and figure out a way to get to development. Like I said, there's a lack of capacity in a lot of towns. So over 40% of Connecticut's towns have participated in this program. We have dozens of new zoning, and we have hundreds of units in the pipeline. And it's not just about creating one development. It's really about changing a town's course of business. So we just profiled 5 towns last month. Guilford, Newtown, Fairfield, Old Saybrook, and Stonington. So the first town that developed a project inside of this was in Old Saybrook, which is just outside of New Haven. So they created 16 units in 2012. Round of applause, right? But that's not the end of the story, because 16 units is a small number of units. But now they're doing 186 units right next to the train station that has no public subsidy, and they want to do more. So, you know, it might have taken 10 years to get this mind shift really occurring, but since it took over 5,500 years to get into this situation, we think that that's pretty great progress in a short amount of time.
Yeah. Well, that's good. So, I mean, I guess that it sounds like, in a sense, there are a lot of efforts. There are a lot of these budding efforts going on. But, you know, I'd be curious, and I think Melissa would be very curious to know, kind of what else should, let's start with the states, right? What else could the states in this region be doing to encourage more affordable and multifamily housing?
Well, you know, I've been giving this some thought. And we're so reliant on new construction. And that's, you know, got a lot of issues, but market is one of them. and then the level of subsidies. So I've been giving some thought that, and during the last recession, was a missed opportunity for some level of government, state, local, to purchase units that were underwater, largely didn't happen. I think that was a missed opportunity.
Yeah.
But now this is really off the wall. Take your 55 and older adult communities. I assume you have those in Connecticut and stuff too, right? They are a looming economic disaster in the next 25 years, partly because of the demographics. Those communities built in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, they're going to be 30 to 50 years old. They're not architecturally significant, folks. You know, they're very average construction. And those people are going to be moving, whether above ground or below ground, they're going to be moving out. And I really don't believe that the next generation is going to be all that interested in moving into those. Now, they are financial entities in and of themselves. They're going to be financial disasters. Mm-hmm. People are going to stop paying their dues, whatever. There's not going to be a lot of mortgages underwater because most of them are bought without mortgages. But the values are going to be going down. I think it's time to start thinking, at least, about using those as options for housing for people under age 55. Remove the age restrictions, or at least plan for removing the age restrictions in 10 years or so. Maybe take a portion of it and dedicate it for affordable housing. Maybe whatever level of government has to come in and purchase the units at market, and then, you know, subsidize the difference. Turn them into rentals, turn them into purchase, it doesn't really matter. Most of them are pretty small in terms of, you know, square footage. They'd be wonderful options for newlyweds, new couples, small families. Now, we have New Jersey, I guess you have it all, you know, it's the whole school children and all that nonsense, but, you know, you got to deal with that no matter what.
Yeah.
I think down the road, that could be a real option that's not new construction.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And Chris?
So I think we've touched upon a couple of things. One is this issue about the number of towns that don't have any multifamily zoning. So we're talking about trying to get more multifamily development. Massachusetts has some legislation that's been proposed to require towns to at least set aside a portion for higher density housing so that they're kind of a fair share idea. It ties into this issue about the water treatment, though. I know there are some communities in the Boston suburbs that have avoided bringing in sewer trunk lines just so that they can't be forced with a 40B. Mm-hmm. Because they'd say, fine, find the land that perks for, you know, a 40-unit development. So I think some way that, you know, forcing the suburban communities to tie into the system would be one. And I think the other piece of this is, I guess, you know, we could talk about building affordable housing, but if it's affordable, it probably means that there's going to have to be some subsidies involved. And somehow both upping the amount of subsidies that are available and maybe tilting the playing field towards putting them in higher-cost communities so that there's some incentive to do that.
Right. So you've got sticks and you've got carrots.
Yeah. And so I think you've got to open the doors. You've got to make sure that the infrastructure will support the density, and then you're going to have to find some way to close the gap between what it costs and what people can pay, and, you know, and creating some incentive structures to put that in these places where we haven't traditionally put it. But it does. Yeah. I mean, I thought, you know, your comment about, you know, who lives in these. Then you do then also have to think about a fair housing part of this, so that you're not just building it for people who already live out there, but opening up the mobility within the metropolitan area.
So can I just stop for one second? I mean, it does sound like, I realize I meant to ask about this. It sounds like all of you have mentioned infrastructure concerns as these are actually legitimate. And they may not tell the whole story. They may be exaggerated, but there are infrastructure needs that would need to be addressed. And so a state could have a role in providing incentive funding to build up the infrastructure that's needed to support.
Yeah, I mean, the lack of sewer has, you know, that's been a standard anti-development tool for many, many years. Not just affordable housing, but towns that don't want any development. But infrastructure, you know, goes beyond that too, and, you know, schools and roads and all those other things.
So I think that's one of the. I mean, I'm glad you came back to it. I think that's one of the potential causes for hope in this field. You know, assuming that we're all working within a time of fiscal constraint, right? So we can't just imagine doubling the size of the subsidy that's available, though I'm going to make a plug about that in 1 second. But you know, you have to think about how we're going to try to work smarter. And I think when you're in the government, anybody who's in the government knows, part of working smarter is how much communication is communicating with your fellow agencies. There's no such thing as a silo when it comes to developing affordable housing or participating in the development of affordable housing. So we increasingly find ourselves at our agency working with environmental agencies, you know, environmental regulatory agencies, health agency. I mean, these are people we've never had to talk to before. The health agencies, if we're doing anything touching supportive housing, or even we're a little bit of a carve-out is for a special needs population, we work with any of the various health agencies. But with DEC or DOH in particular, and then there's the, you know, you start talking about water infrastructure, there's EFC, there's this whole constellation of state agencies that have to do that, that touch on the on things like sewer infrastructure, and you're exactly right, it's always an issue. But I think it's an opportunity as well, because the fact is, and I don't know if I'm sure you've done some work on this, the fiscal impact of maintaining low density eventually is going to reflect itself in a town's infrastructure, right? Mm-hmm. And you can't, I mean, Long Island, for example, we've done a lot, the state has done a lot of work in the last couple of years after Hurricane Sandy on water quality and the interrelation between between stormwater, extreme weather, and water quality in the bays, in the Long Island bays and in the ocean. Well, once there's growing public awareness of that, and thanks to Suffolk County Executive Malone, who's really made this an issue for him, for his administration, once people start to realize why it is that they can't swim in the bay anymore, they realize that a lot of it has to do with the septic infrastructure, the inadequacy of the septic infrastructure. And by the way, somebody points out to them that paying $12,000 a year to have your septic system cleaned out is probably a lot more expensive and hard, difficult for you than simply having a CSO in your neighborhood where you may have a water bill for a little while, but basically it's going to work out better for you. The government can step in and say, look, we'll make this possible for you, but you're going to have to make some changes. And I think that's where the government has to act smart and make sure that you're reflecting that whatever it is we do reflects all of our priorities, not just not just the environmental priority, but also the housing priority, everything else. That's where you start to get the camel's nose under the tent.
You've got some leverage.
Absolutely, and we've done that in storm recovery.
Yeah, that is cause for hope. So, Elaine,
what else could the states
be doing?
I think that the state really plays a tremendous role with all of the funding that you were mentioning, in terms of how that funding is used. What's the criteria? What's the scoring process for the proposals, et cetera? Again, so that we begin to stop this pattern that we have had with segregated housing. It's not just that it's not good for it's not good for limiting the opportunities for people, but it's not sustainable for us regionally. And we haven't had the discussion about the real economic impact of concentrated poverty, of generations of children who are not able to function in the economy. And so it is broad. I don't know why it is. Because it's so clear to me, I don't know why it's not clear to others, but it's always a tack-on. It's, we never really talk about it head-on. Someone like me has to bring it up. I think that we in the civil rights community are failing because somehow we're not making the case clearly enough or something. But we know that, spatial planning impacts the inequality, either creating equality or creating inequality, and yet we don't consistently make those kinds of decisions that would make a difference in a concrete way. And I realize it's complicated with the affordable housing because you're going to have to back up to say, yes, we don't have shovel-ready projects. You know, when these RFPs go out and you're supposed to get your proposal in next month or some crazy schedule, you don't have shovel-ready projects for the challenging task of building this housing in high opportunity areas. So it does require kind of backing several steps up to say, what else is the state going to do with its money that's more flexible to make sure that we can actually facilitate that? And then the final thing I would say is the something like the proposal that's being put forward, you know, by RPA needs to be in our toolbox, in our toolkit. But I would like our colleagues from Massachusetts and Connecticut, because I've been in several, you know, roundtables when this was discussed, you know, one was coordinated by the Ford Foundation, et cetera. And by now, we should be able to say who's living in those developments. And I've yet to hear, you know, we have X percent, you know, white folks or African Americans or Latino or whoever, you know, might be in the larger pot in your region. And I think that we need to know so that we can learn from that and make sure. I do fear, because I've seen how racial preferences in particular have played out on Long Island, I fear that if you have segregation in Massachusetts, and I lived in Massachusetts for a while, so I do know that you do, that those racial preferences will play out and you will have segregated housing in this, what's supposed to be this new resource that can open up more opportunities. So I think that we need to be open-eyed, clear-eyed, really look carefully so that we can help each other in the region and learn from each other, and so try to get better each time we do it. So our program in New York, which we will do, will you know, have learned from the three other states that we're talking about.
Yeah. Catherine, what else should we be doing at the state level?
Well, I think it all trickles down to the most local level. So I think continued engagement with the towns, and the state can play a role inside of that too, because even though towns build and pass the zoning, the engagement and education has to continue, because there will be a new first selectman, our mayors, there'll be new zoning commissioners. You know, just because NewGen has two projects that have been approved for zoning doesn't mean I wasn't down there 6 months ago at a town meeting to have similar conversations. The second would be supporting town planners and the planning capacity. I think that
I like that
answer. You know, we're a job creator there too, right, Ingrid? For your students. And then the third part, which I'll echo with what Jamie said and what I heard in previous sessions, was this need for coordinated state support and investment. And it cannot be siloed. We've gotten it to the town level of housing has to be part of every decision that you make and has to be a component, and similar so for the state. So any, you know, funding that goes to brownfields, what's the housing component? Is there an affordable housing component for that? Same thing for infrastructure grants or any other grants that are provided to the towns. Housing needs to be part of that decision-making process.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
And Ingrid, could I just say one other thing?
Yeah.
We do need to fully take advantage of the mandate to affirmatively further fair housing.
Yes, thank you.
That has been, and HUD has been to, you know, to blame, because HUD is the agency, the federal agency, responsible for implementation of this, and they've been asleep at the switch. Now they're trying to get to not be asleep, but then the recipients of the funding, and that's certainly the state, and it's some other municipalities that receive funding directly, you know, they have been asleep at the switch. So there hasn't been the kind of attention to a tool that we do have in terms of, are we really affirmatively furthering fair housing? And if not, what are we doing? Are we even cutting off funding, if that's the only thing that people will hear? And so I think that we have a tool, we need to use it.
Yeah, thank you. That was where I was going to go next. I want to open it up for questions. We have a great audience here, and I think we have about 10 minutes, is that right? I'd love for questions. So are there microphones around? So, here.
Hi, Richard Manson with List. Just an observation to your last question about what can states do, because you've got wonderful suggestions already, but something new. The philanthropic community is an interesting wild card in
how it reacts to what are local problems. And in each of these three marketplaces, mm-hmm. there is a robust and frankly quite wealthy yep. philanthropic community, particularly the community foundation level. Yep. And as foundations are risk averse, but they also know that they're responsible to act on behalf of their wider community. The more that state leadership, whether it be at the commissioner level or above, can take the steps to proactively engage their philanthropic community, some of the issues that then have to get played out at the local level, which are about relationships and trust, mm-hmm. most likely are things to take advantage. Of course, to some extent, I don't want to give a commercial too much for Massachusetts, but the Boston Foundation, for example, played a major role behind the scenes and with money to advance. And in these three states, New York most likely has more resources that's going in, but certainly from List perspective in New Jersey and Connecticut, mm-hmm. we're only scratching the surface of philanthropy's role in the affordable housing issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Good for thought.
Thank you for that comment. So we've got over here and then back in the back also.
Yes, my name is Ray Ocasio. I'm with La Casa del Petro in Newark, New Jersey. And I just wanted to point out the suburban title that we've given this panel, I think, is falsely identifying the areas we're talking about, particularly in New Jersey, because you have everything from towns and villages to cities, and they all have different dynamics. And when you talk about fair share housing, we've had the Mount Laurel case, which yeah. I think was adequately described. But I also want to point out there's been some good examples of Mount Laurel where housing has been integrated. At the same time, there have been some terrible practices, such as transferring out by payments the ability to transfer your obligations to localities, often cities like Patterson, Newark, and Camden. The real question, I think, goes down to the political will. I mean, clearly we've had a governor who has not been willing to exercise, follow the letter of the law, and much less provide the funding to do so. So I think that's an issue. The political will becomes terribly important. Mm-hmm. I think the other point I would make out is that all of these towns and villages that have objections, whether it's NIMBY or it's number of children in schools, etc., are really concerned behind that, whether it's prejudice or not. There's also a financial reason. These towns are supported by local taxes, real estate taxes, yep. and that places an undue burden on any number of people, from the elderly or to building new housing. And so I think we have to rethink about how we fund local government so that it's not dependent upon real estate, so that the threat of having more families move in becomes an issue in terms of voting for it. And the last thing, somewhat related to what Richard had to say, there in all these communities, there are, whether it's neighborhood or citywide or countywide, there are nonprofit organizations, community development corporations such as mine, that are engaged in housing, and they're able to participate in the market, in the planning and the development and execution of housing that meets the fair housing, but also meets the affordability question. And I think they have to be put into the equation.
Okay. Thank you for those comments. So you guys are, you're all letting the panelists off the hook here. So let's get some questions. Do you have a question for the panel? Okay. Oh. Great comments, though. I don't mean to.
And thank you. And great content this afternoon. I thought the comment about the zoning and planning boards was spot on, particularly about the lack of diversity on the planning and zoning boards. So, for instance, in a lot of communities where my clients appear before, the youngster on the boards is about 65 years old, and they're all entrenched. So my question actually to the RPA folks is, what kind of outreach do you do on a sustained level to these planning and zoning boards? Do you have a PR campaign that's ongoing? If not, are you considering funding one? And if we can't move these planning and zoning boards because of the lack of diversity or whatnot, how do we move the people? Because government follows people. Thank you.
I guess I'll take that one.
Yeah.
Anybody else wants to jump in? But I'd say at this particular stage, we've been identifying the problems and sort of defining the policies in the next stage in the process. Well, and it's sort of built into this planning process, working with our community partners to figure out what the implementation pieces look like on the ground for these policies that we're talking about embedding and refining for the fourth plan. And a big one that's come up for us, which is why the last slide was in there, that was sort of a latecomer from our previous versions of this, was this education piece. And so really, working with our community partners and getting out in the region to do just what you're talking about and figuring out a mechanism to educate the localities as to what they really need to do to move this forward, because it really will have to happen at the local level, even if the mandates come down from the state.
So, yeah.
Ingrid,
another question here?
You missed someone.
Oh, did I miss? Yeah. I'm sorry.
So I actually work for IFCA Housing Network, which is Affordable Housing Network, but I'm also a policymaker in my local community. So now I have the power to make a mandatory inclusionary zoning law, and if I decided to do 20%, a developer would say to me, we can't afford to do that because the market won't bear it. So my question is, what state is New York State playing in the mixed-use, walkable urban communities where people can actually be able to create that kind of housing in the new market?
Sorry, so
well, you, New York.
Sorry.
Oh, yeah, no, I heard New York, but I didn't catch the question. The question was, how, what?
So, yeah, what role do you play as far as financing?
Oh. Oh, sure.
Right, if there's a mandatory inclusionary zoning requirement of 20% and the developers say we can't afford to do that, what kind of subsidies can
you
bring?
Sure. Well, that's a great question. That's the business that we're in. I mean, it's not a problem that we're faced with all that often outside of New York City, because most places in New York, at least in this area of New York City, don't have that, in the state, don't have inclusionary zoning. But that's exactly what we stand to do. When a developer comes to us with a project, whether that has an affordable housing component to it, we provide the capital subsidy. We'll do everything. We'll provide the whole stack. So the capital subsidy, the tax exempt bond financing, other grants that are available to us, and we'll stitch together if there's other agencies that have. Whether there's an energy component or an environmental component, we'll find and work with a developer and the local government, if need be, to put together a project. And by the way, I'm sorry. And we'll often bring in. There's often. I mean, a little advertisement here for LISC. My friend Richard works for LISC, and probably others do as well. That's an important role that they'll play, is helping put together, provide technical assistance if there's a project in an area that really hasn't had this kind of experience before.
I would just say that we do have some builders that they don't have a problem. You know, they can make the numbers work for 20%, but they get whittled down by the municipality that doesn't want, well, you know, they don't want any, but they want, if they're going to take something, they're going to take much less. So I think it's a mixed bag. I don't know exactly where you're at, but there's a mixed bag out there in terms of availability of developers and what they can make work or not work.
Yeah, it's going to vary a lot across markets.
You know, on the issue of inclusionary zoning, there was a missed opportunity a few months ago. The United States Supreme Court had an opportunity to hear a City of San Jose, California case, which had a mandatory inclusionary zoning decision approved by the California Supreme Court. U.S. Supreme Court declined to take the case. Would have been, I don't know which way they would have gone out, but it would have been good to get clarity on that issue. But on the issue of inclusionary zoning, this is one area where I actually think zoning, the current bad zoning, actually could help. And that is, if you say to a developer who wants to do something, and particularly in the area of adaptive reuse these days, because the zoning, it almost never fits, you know, what you want to do. So a developer comes that wants to do something. Say to him or her, great, we're going to work with you, but as a condition, you're going to make some percent, 10 to 20% affordable. Or if it's a, you know, non-residential thing, you're going to make a contribution to an affordable housing fund. They're going to be willing to do it, because without the power of change, that the zoning change that's needed by the planning or zoning authorities, they're going nowhere. So I think it's an opportunity to take this bad zoning and actually use it as a levered tool.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, that's a nice positive note to end on.
Yes.
So please join me in thanking this terrific panel.
Thank goodness for bad zoning.